The number one thing I can recommend to people is if you're interested, ask somebody. That is the main reason I got to be able to do all these really cool diagnostic procedures, is because I kept bugging people. Yeah. If you're truly curious and truly find joy in it, just keep asking.
Yeah.
Just keep saying, can I watch? Can I shadow?
There's electrodes that are placed, and those are called grids.
No. So grids and strips are different. Those are, it's still technically phase two monitoring. Mm-hmm. Those are done with, they remove part of the skull and they'll put the grid or strip on the surface of the brain, mm-hmm. and it records the potentials from the surface of the brain. So you don't have the skull impeding those electrical signals, because the electrical signals of the brain are very small.
Right.
The electrical signals of the heart are very big, which is why if you put an EKG sticker on, you see that nice big,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah. And you have to turn down the gain.
And you have to turn down the gain, yeah. and you see it, you know, everywhere else, because yeah. it's a really big electrical potential.
Right.
But for the brain, they're very small. And so if it's an area that they are concerned about being closer to the surface of the brain, they may do a grid or strip. That's really common in cortical mapping cases, mm-hmm. like in the operating room. But I've noticed it's a lot more common now for SEEG. Like SEEG's kind of taken over. It's been very popular in Europe for a couple of decades now.
Yeah, I heard that.
And it's getting a lot more popular here.
Yeah.
It's a lot less invasive. So taking off a big chunk of your skull and placing an electrode on top of your brain, even though everything's sterile, there's always risk for infection. It's a little bit harder to heal from, you know, yeah. it's all these things.
Yeah.
So SEEG or stereotactic EEG, they'll make very small holes in the skull. They'll put little anchors in those holes, and then they'll slide electrodes in through the brain. Mm-hmm. The planning process is rigorous, because you need to make sure you're not hitting any veins or arteries. You're not going through important structures, but you also want your trajectory to reach the intended target.
Yeah. And how are they making sure that they don't hit those vital mm-hmm. arteries?
So they'll likely have the patient go through an angiogram, an MRI with and without contrast, just mm-hmm. to show where those veins and arteries are on mm-hmm. the patient. And they'll have a 3D model of within whatever software they're using of the patient's imaging, their angiogram, so they can see all the veins and arteries in the brain. And then they'll start planning the trajectories. And typically there's multiple electrodes. It can be all on one side. It can be on both sides. It really just depends on the patient. A lot of times, even if a patient on scalp EEG shows right temporal lobe epilepsy, right temporal lobe seizures, it could be coming from the left hippocampus, mm-hmm. which is very deep within the brain, and then quickly spreading the right.
Yeah.
So they may have an electrode or two coming from the left to check those deeper structures. So they'll put they'll arrange the electrodes in a way that they're hitting all of the intended targets. And these electrodes have contacts on them every couple of millimeters. And each of those contacts is essentially an electrode that you'd have on the scalp. So then it's not just, okay, it's an electrode that's a few inches long and I get the end point. Mm-hmm. You get lots of information all the way up.
Yeah, because going back to what you said, if the seizure is generated from the hippocampus, mm-hmm. but it's going to the temporal lobe, and let's say it's a pretty strong signal, mm-hmm. and you can easily think, oh, this is coming from the temporal lobe, and then it doesn't make sense to chop off the temporal lobe and then to find out it's actually coming deep within the brain hippocampus, for example.
Right.
So these electrodes, what I hear you say is is it a needle type looking?
It kind of looks like a needle.
Okay.
I almost equate it to like the IV catheter. So after they place an IV, the little plastic part that's left
yeah.
in you,
yeah,
it kind of looks like that.
Okay.
And then it has little silver contacts on it.
Okay. So it looks kind of like a needle, but then there's silver little mm-hmm. electrodes that you can visibly see.
Yes.
And then when they stick this needle into the brain, deep within the brain, let's say they go actually to the hippocampus, mm-hmm. I'm assuming there's a electrode at the very tip of that.
Yes.
So it touches the hippocampus to make sure the hippocampus is covered. Then it goes throughout the temporal lobe, I'm assuming, is mm-hmm. let's say that's a trajectory. Mm-hmm. And then those little bitty electrodes, once a patient has a seizure, if the electrode is not picking it up at the hippocampus, but it actually is picking it up at mm-hmm. the temporal lobe. So you can confidently say, once those electrodes are picking up the electrical activity in the temporal lobe, that this actually is a temporal lobe deviated or derived seizure focus in mm-hmm. the temporal lobe. Then you can start making those plans to remove the temporal lobe instead of mm-hmm. it being a hippocampal issue.
Exactly. It's extra insurance to make sure that we are as certain as possibly can be that it is coming from this location.
Yeah.
Especially because you can't see electrical signals from the hippocampus on a scalp EEG. And it's such a deep structure and it's so closely related to the temporal lobe on either side of the brain. So it's important to make sure that the patient's going to stop having seizures.
Yeah.
If they go through this.
So I have two questions about mm-hmm. that. Number one is, and I'll ask both questions and then we'll start with number one. Number one is, how long do these patients have this in their brain? And then number two, who are these epileptic candidates who have to figure out if it's a hippocampal issue versus a temporal lobe issue? Hmm. So with number one, how long are these electrodes actually surgically in place? How long do they have them in their skull, in their brain?
Mm-hmm. They're typically in place for several days, a week, maybe 2 weeks tops. A big part of it is they want to make sure that they get enough information. So several seizures of the same type. Some patients will have different seizure types. And so they want to make sure they have a good sampling of each. Mm-hmm. And then, so it could be 3 days.
Yeah.
It's likely at least 3 days, just so the patient isn't going through essentially surgery twice.
Yeah.
In such a short span.
And are they admitted into the hospital?
Oh,
for
yes.
This? So
oh,
they're
yes.
not, they're not going home. It's not
no,
like
no, you're not okay. going anywhere.
Okay, good.
You are staying in the epilepsy monitoring unit. You will have, likely have a one-to-one nurse or certified nursing assistant mm-hmm. be there for your safety, because if you fall with these in, that's going to hurt a little bit more.
Yeah.
So we just want to make sure that they're very safe. But other than that, they go throughout their day normally.
Yeah.
Their head will be wrapped with sterile wraps to make sure that they're not, you know, fiddling with it and everything.
Yeah.
And they'll watch TV, they'll eat, they'll drink. A lot of times they'll experience some jaw pain, and that's just from electrodes going in, you know, in the temporal lobe. You have your masseter muscle that goes up into your scalp and just a little sore. But other than that, they get up and go to the bathroom. They do not shower under any circumstances.
Yeah.
Because you are hooked up to electrical equipment into your brain.
Yeah.
So it's the same as EEG, you know, electrical safety is important.
I can understand how that would be not a good idea. At all.
Horrible idea.
So for the concerned patient that's listening in, mm-hmm. are these patients, do they have to shave their head? How do they prep for this?
So they don't have to shave their entire head. The neurosurgeon will likely shave where they need to place the electrodes, especially because what they'll do is they'll take neuronavigation, which is kind of a 3D system, mm-hmm. and they'll register it to the patient's brain, and they'll register it against the patient's imaging.
Wow.
So then they can see in real time how deep into the brain they're going with these different instruments. It's really interesting. It's super cool. But they need to have it, you know, as close to their scalp as possible. So if they're able to get to their scalp without shaving their head, They'll preserve it, especially for kiddos. You know, they don't want to shave their head unless they have to.
Yeah.
And I've seen some surgeons who just take clippers and shave the little spots that they're going to put the anchor bolts. And so it's not really noticeable unless you pull their hair up and look at it. But some of them, especially if there's a large number of electrodes in a small area, they will shave that area. But they don't necessarily have to have their whole head shaved by any means.
For the doctors that are actually doing that, doing the little bitty shavings of the head to minimize the aesthetic look of what this patient's going to look like after they leave, kudos to them.
Yeah.
First of all, because I did a little research because I've actually never seen this before, but the research that I saw, and without being too crude, but it's the best way I can describe it, is it looks like, do you remember Spokey Dokes on your bicycle?
Yeah.
Okay. What I saw was it looked like little plastic, colorful plastic ends that you could tell there was something going inside the scalp, but maybe there was something on top of that scalp with the wire coming out of that.
Yes.
Is that an accurate depiction of what that looks like? And if so, what are those? What's the purpose of those little plastic? I'm assuming they're plastic.
Yeah.
Things.
Yeah. So you're correct. They do stick out of the scalp a bit. So those are the anchor bolts that are used to kind of house the electrode, because you don't want it slipping and sliding around. That's not going to give you accurate data. So what they do is they place the anchor bolt into the hole they drilled into the skull. It's very small. It's usually like 5 millimeters, I believe, 4 or 5 millimeters. And then they'll take a stylet and put it through that hole just to kind of create that path, because the electrodes themselves are very flexible. So it does go kind of around certain structures, but you also don't want it to just buckle up on you.
Right.
So they'll put the electrode in, and then they have these caps that go on top of the anchor bolts, and that will hold the wire in place. And a lot of the companies that have them, it's specialized so that it doesn't twist the wire either as they're tightening it. And then that way it's secured in there.
Yeah.
They'll likely then do a little stress loop of that wire onto the scalp with a simple, you know, stitch or two. And then coming off of it will be this line. And it looks like kind of like a plug. And that's what plugs into the electrode cord from the EEG technologist side.
Fascinating.
Yeah.
Technology is absolutely insane.
It's insane.
And it's for these reasons that it just blows my mind.
Yeah.
So for the patient's sake, and for actually caregivers who are actually going to talk to the patient before they have this procedure done, is there any complaints of pain? You had mentioned maybe temporal lobe because of the muscles that it's actually going through. But other than that, you know, the brain doesn't have any nerve endings,
exactly.
Right? So is there any complaints, or what are the common complaints that patients might have as far as discomfort?
Mm-hmm. So a lot of it is like jaw pain, because
what you just mentioned.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It can also be just from, you know, your scalp and your facial muscles are very closely linked. And so there, you might just be a little achy. Mm-hmm. You might have a slight headache. Again, that's just because of the muscles on your scalp that are being kind of infiltrated by these bolts and everything. Very rarely do they complain of, you know, double vision or blurry vision. A lot of times that's if the electrodes are close to the occipital lobe or the visual cortex.
Mm-hmm.
But typically discomfort is very minimal.
Yeah. And I know this might be out of your scope, but post procedure, are they available? Are there certain pain relievers available for these patients to take if they're actually having discomfort?
Yeah, a lot of times doctors will prescribe, you know, Tylenol, ibuprofen, things like that, and that will take care of the discomfort they have. It's very rare that they have discomfort that cannot be controlled by these typical over-the-counter medications.
Well, that's good news for patients that are actually might be listening right now and trying to figure out what's going on. First of all, I also want to address that Shannon and I, we get excited about these things because we have seen patients' lives changed because they've had these diagnostic testing and they have, you know, gone through surgeries and we've seen lives changed. If you're going through this, if you're listening and you're going through this, just know that there's people like Shannon out there who are so passionate about helping you and getting the answers and making your quality of life as best as possible. That's where you're seeing our joy, because we really do geek out on this kind of stuff.
Absolutely. You know,
this is our passion. We go into this maybe not knowing how the impact that we're going to have on people, but it's pure joy that you see us talking about this. So for the patients who, I think that's really good information, knowing that, because if I was on the other side, I would be completely worried about how this is going to actually, you know, hurt. What am I going to actually feel? So I think that's a good little clarification of, you know, there's going to be some discomfort, but all in all, it's going to be an experience that's well worth it, mm-hmm. and not too bad pain-wise.
Yeah, I agree. And also to add another reason why we wrap the head as much as we do, because those anchor bolts stick out a little bit, we want to pad the head so that when you're laying on your pillow, you're not putting pressure directly on these anchor bolts. So it's, you almost look like Toad from Mario Kart.
Yeah.
Yeah. You got a big kind of mushroom head full of wrapping and dressing.
Yeah.
It also, it's, you know, seeing your head with all these essentially metal pins in it is alarming. It's scary. And, you know, a lot of times people who are about to undergo this SEEG placement, they compare themselves to like pinhead or something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I feel like we're getting close to the end mm-hmm. of this patient's journey, the story that we're telling. The patient, just to recap, fails ASMs, has EEGs, does all these other diagnostic testing. Things are looking good for them to be candidates for epilepsy surgery. Mm-hmm. This 8-year-old patient that you're talking about as an example.
Jane.
She learns that she can actually have the temporal lobe removed because maybe they did the depth electrodes. Is that still a term that they use, depth electrodes? Mm-hmm. So they use the depth electrodes, found out it's not a hippocampal issue, but more of a temporal lobe issue. Then the doctor has to have, I'm assuming, these conversations, very hard, I'm assuming, mm-hmm. as well, to have these conversations with the parents, with the patients. Hey, listen, we have to take this temporal lobe out. The right temporal lobe out, because this is where the seizures are originating. Mm-hmm. And so what happens then? Let's mm-hmm. say the patient and the patient's family really talk about it. They decide this is the best option. Mm-hmm. What happens from there?
So from there, they'll of course schedule the surgery. They go over all of the risks. Oftentimes, especially for these types of cases, they're not saying we have to take this out. They'll present it as, this is where your seizures are coming from.
Okay.
We've checked the surrounding areas. We are able to safely remove it if that's what you'd want to do. But they'll also offer alternatives. So perhaps they'll want to try like an RNS or responsive neurostimulator first. So that has it's very similar to a VNS or a vagus nerve stimulator. That one is placed in the chest on the vagus nerve, and it sends electrical pulses to the brain. That's great for generalized epilepsies. The RNS is good for focal epilepsies. So especially if they have more than one seizure focus, they can put the electrodes to different locations and it'll send little pulses when it detects a seizure coming.
Inside the brain. Okay, so first of all, let me backtrack.
Yeah.
So let's distinguish you said VNS yes. and the RNS. Mm-hmm. So the VNS is a coil that wraps around the vagus nerve mm-hmm. that whenever these patients have what's called an aura, whenever they're feeling these seizures coming on, a very typical situation with a VNS is you can see it actually sticking out their chest, right? Mm-hmm. And so whenever these patients have these auras and they can feel a seizure coming on, they'll have a magnetic band right? Is this still used?
It's yeah, it can be a magnetic band. It can be also just a regular magnet.
Magnet.
Yeah, just a magnet of some kind.
And what that magnet does, if I'm not mistaken, is it activates that vagus nerve to kind of send a signal and kind of jumpstart the vagus nerve to, hey, don't have this seizure. Don't do a full-blown, generalized, you know, overtaking of the brain.
Right.
And so that's really good for patients with auras.
Right. You're not too far off. So that is one purpose of the VNS, but it also is sending consistent electrical signals to the brain.
So continuously sending signals, even if they don't activate it with that magnet.
So what it's doing is it's sending these steady pulses of electricity via the vagus nerve up into the brain, and that is helping to prevent the seizures from forming in the first place. Uh-huh. And then the seizures that are forming, then they can swipe that magnet and it gives an extra boost of electrical activity to kind of stop it in its tracks.
Okay, so you don't have to have an aura to be a VNS candidate.
No.
Okay, well that's great to know.
Yeah.
And do you know like what the frequency of these pulses are? Is it one every 30 minutes, one every 15, or is it case by case basis?
I believe it's case by case, but I feel like it's a lot more frequent than that. It might be like every few seconds.
Okay.
But I've never been asked that question. I've never thought of it. So right. I'd be curious to know.
The little that I do know about VNS is some of the side effects is they can actually feel it, right? Can they feel that stimulation?
I'm not sure about being able to feel it.
Or maybe not feel it, but there's something that happens vocally where maybe they have a higher pitch. Is that something you've heard of?
I personally haven't heard of that. The symptoms that I've seen in patients that get a VNS are more kind of like a gastrointestinal because your vagus nerve does travel down to your, you know, your gastrointestinal area. Yeah.
And so that affects it.
It can give like kind of like weird tummy feelings. It's because it's usually children that get it. And so they say like my tummy hurts or things like that. But I haven't personally encountered the higher pitched voice, but it would make sense because it's so close to your vocal cords. And, you know, that's the vagus nerve also, you know, innervates your vocal cords.
Yeah.
So it would make sense.
Yeah. So VNS aside, we've got that. Mm-hmm. We've got a good overview of that. RNS, which I, to be honest with you, don't know much about.
Yeah.
So tell me a little bit about what an RNS is, and maybe we start with a candidate.
Yeah. So a good candidate for an RNS or responsive nerve stimulator is someone who has focal epilepsy or multifocal epilepsy. So someone who may not be a candidate for like a lobectomy or removing that portion of the brain, but still needs a surgical intervention. So it is placed, I believe it's anchored on the skull, usually like behind the ear. And then the electrodes, I think you can have up to four, if I'm not mistaken. So four different foci in the brain. And it kind of gets to know your brain over time. So it's like a mini EEG.
Oh, so cool.
It does not send regular pulses, but when it's detecting a seizure from one of these foci, then it will send electrical pulses to stop it. So it's much, much more focused and doesn't send that constant electrical stimulation.
Okay. So this is Jane's possible route to therapy.
So Jane could do the RNS, especially, you know, she's 8. It's a big surgery, but children are resilient. They're the best candidates for lobectomies or hemispherectomies or whatever, because their brains are still forming. And even if they take out a portion that, you know, potentially had some sort of language, memory, whatever it may be, a lot of times the remaining portions of the brain will kind of take over that job if they're young enough. Yeah. So she could do the RNS if the parents really don't want to do a lobectomy. But lobectomy, I mean, I'm not an MD, but it seems like that is probably the better choice of the two. I'm also
The lobectomy, yes.
Okay. I'm also not positive that the RNS is approved in children.
Okay.
I believe it's they may have gone down to age 12.
Okay.
But it is a newer therapy device as well. It hasn't been around as long as the VNS has. So they typically don't put these, yeah, you know, new devices or medications in children until it's very well tested.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
So they're sitting with the neurologist and the neurosurgeon, or epileptologist and neurosurgeon, and they decide, yes, let's go forward with the right temporal lobectomy. So they know all the risks. They understand like what the pre-op and the post-op is going to look like, and they decide to move forward.
So from hey, a neurologist is ordering a EEG to find out what's going on, mm-hmm, to this, how far are we looking? Is this weeks, months?
Months, easily. Yeah. Especially if it's early in the diagnosis, it's going to easily be months, maybe a year, because they do need to trial these different medications. Medications, right, will always be the first line of defense because it's non-invasive. And we talk a lot about failing an ASM, and that doesn't necessarily mean that your seizures continue at the same rate or get worse. It can also be that the side effects are devastating to your life.
Mm.
So, you know, a lot of these medications have a lot of psychological side effects and can cause very severe depression, even suicidal ideations. Mm. And that's devastating for people.
Yeah.
So especially for these kids. So just know, like, when we say failing an ASM doesn't mean that your seizures are staying exactly the same. So they may not even have repeat EEGs until it's time to start this process of, okay, let's maybe do phase two monitoring. They'll likely do another EEG beforehand. But between the different anti-seizure medications, if they're having clinical seizures or they know they're still having seizures, they may not do another EEG. If it feels like they're not having any, they likely will do an EEG just to make sure they're not having subclinical seizures, which are seizures that don't show any outward effects.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of that happens in sleep. A lot of it happens if the patient isn't being closely watched, like with our absence seizure patients, they'll like kind of stare off for a blip and then come back, yeah, and they don't realize they lost any time because only seconds have passed. So it depends on where they are in that process and how long it takes. If they had already tried several medications and they're from the start of the diagnostic test, the imaging, diagnostic imaging and the surgery, we're probably looking at a few months.
Yeah.
Like three to 6 months.
So it truly sounds like a case by case basis.
Yes.
Which for those patients who are actually just checking off boxes, yeah, mm-hmm, unfortunately surgery is the treatment plan that is going to be the most effective and you have to go through that.
Mm-hmm.
But for those who check off those boxes really fast, I'm sure that that's a lot easier to handle than those who are just trying to figure out, I've got to do all kinds of testing. They weren't too sure about that, so I have to do this, and mm-hmm, kind of bouncing around, and not until maybe a year later where they actually have the confirmation to actually go through epilepsy surgery.
Yes.
I can understand how that could be very frustrating for that patient, yeah, and the patient's family.
Oh,
and,
of course.
And yeah.
Of course. And especially for, you know, your loved ones, they don't want to see you in pain or suffering or struggling. And a lot of younger, even adolescents, you know, they want to be able to drive, and you have to be seizure free for so many months to be able to drive a car. And I don't know about you, but getting that license for the first time, that was a huge,
yeah,
moment. Oh, lots, absolutely, of freedom. And yeah, if I wasn't able to get that, that would be really tough.
Sweet 8-year-old Jane,
mm-hmm,
finds out that this is the right path.
So then they'll have her come in for surgery. If they're doing a right temporal lobectomy, they will have to shave that area of her scalp, but mm-hmm, she'll have a cool, you know, side fade.
Yeah.
So
which is in now.
It's in, yeah, exactly. She'll be, yeah, super cool.
Yeah.
They'll make an incision in the scalp. They'll remove part of the skull in order to replace it later. And then they will use, again, that neuro navigation to ensure that they're only getting the area that they want to be getting. Sometimes they may do intraoperative EEG, which is also known as ECOG. So they'll do that. They may stimulate the areas of the brain that are around that structure to make sure that it's showing up where they think it's showing up. They may place a strip or a grid to, again, make sure it's where they think it is. But more than likely, the neuronavigation, it's very sophisticated, very specific, and that's enough to make sure that they've gotten that area out. And then they put the skull back on. They'll take a CT or MRI, ensure that everything looks good, and stitch them up. They'll stay in the hospital for a few days, of course, after brain surgery. And then just regular checkups after that.
This is the treatment that we are hoping that is going to completely improve Jane's life.
Yes.
Throughout her life, where she could be suffering with and living with epilepsy her entire life. This could change that trajectory to maybe possibly never having seizures again throughout her entire life. Which is exactly why we do what we do.
It is.
Speaking of doing what we do, this is a heavy-based technologist community that we're in, and most of the people listening are technologists. You had mentioned ECOG and during the surgery. What is an EEG technologist's place there in ECOG? And then I also want to talk about what you specialize in, IOM. And I want to see where that actually fits into what we just went through Jane's story. The surgery, obviously, the all the EEG is done by an EEG technologist and in collaboration and in working with the neurologist, the epileptologist, and all the other physicians involved. And so then we get to surgery. Let's talk about the EEG technologist's role from then on, what's happening there, and how can they, if they are interested, how can they get to that point?
Yeah, absolutely. So in these lobectomies or any type of brain resection, typically they'll have a surgical neurophysiologist or an IOM technologist in the room, and they'll be performing sensory and motor testing during the surgery to make sure that those structures are remaining intact. Not only because they may be close to the sensory or motor cortex of the brain, but because they there's also always possibility of a stroke or a clot or, you know, anything like that. And so they can catch that very quickly using these different modalities. So that would be done by a CNIM or IOM technologist. And then it's to me, it's a little bit of a gray area because I started in EEG and went to long-term monitoring and then went into IOM.
Which is a pretty typical...
It's not.
It's not.
Surprisingly.
Oh, okay.
I thought it was, but
so
apparently it's not.
Yeah.
Oftentimes people go straight into IOM, or maybe they have their evoked potential and go into IOM or nerve conduction.
Which makes sense.
And then IOM. Like, that's a little bit more common.
Okay.
And so being able to read an EEG is a skill that's not necessarily found in you know, your average IOM technologist.
Oh, wow.
A lot of times we will use like a limited EEG, maybe an 8-channel, maybe a 4-channel. A lot of times during my typical IOM cases, whether it's scoliosis or, you know, removing a thyroid, whatever it may be, we'll use a 4-channel EEG, and that is just to test the level of anesthesia that the patient's on.
Right.
Just to see if their brain is suppressed enough that we can get good signals for SSEPs, or which is somatosensory evoked potentials, or you know, whatever it may be, just to make sure they're deep enough under anesthesia that we'll get clean signals, because as your brain wakes up, more waves happen, and then you can't see the small wave we're looking for. So having in facilities that can have both the IOM technologist and the EEG technologist in the OR with them, that is perfect. Because you have kind of like the elite of both sides being able to work together to monitor the patient safely and appropriately. But especially if they're not utilizing the ECOG, they may not need an EEG technologist in the actual epilepsy surgery itself. It typically will be an IOM technologist if they if they deem it necessary. I personally think it's important to have. It doesn't hurt.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't hurt to have extra precaution and sure. an extra set of eyes on the rest of the body while the neurosurgeon is looking directly at the brain. But not every insurance carrier will approve it, and not every hospital has the capability to do it. It doesn't necessarily mean that your surgery is unsafe. It's just some people choose to use it and some people choose not to.
Yeah. So let's talk about IOM as a job, because mm-hmm. I know some of our listeners are EEG techs actually looking to get into the IOM space, mm-hmm. which I'm just figuring out isn't the typical route.
Yeah.
But there are a lot of EEG technologists like yourself that actually do go into IOM just because there is some synergy there.
Oh, absolutely.
And we all seem to mingle and go to the same conferences.
Yeah.
So if I'm an EEG tech and I'm looking to kind of branch into IOM, number one, how would you start? But also number two, another question would be, can you do EEG and IOM at the same job? Mm-hmm. Or do you have to dedicate all of your time as an IOM or as a CINEM tech, which is the ones doing the IOMs, or EEG tech only?
So a lot of it depends on the facility. I was very fortunate in my last facility at Gillette Children's in St. Paul to be able to do both EEG and IOM. It just depended on which day it was. Sometimes I'd be in surgery. Sometimes I'd be on our epilepsy monitoring unit. Sometimes I'd be at the outpatient clinic. It just really depended on the patient care needs and the availability of me being in the OR. The number one thing I can recommend to people is, if you're interested, ask somebody. Like, ask your director, ask your supervisor. That is the only reason. Oh, maybe not the only reason, but that is the main reason I got to be able to do all these really cool diagnostic procedures, is because I kept bugging people. Yeah.
You were curious.
I was so curious. I was like, hey, you know, Lori always goes and does these MSI patients. Can I come with her once? I want to see how she does it. Oh, like Brian does the PET scans. Can I go with him?
Yeah.
And I just pestered them enough that I think they let me do it just to get me out of their office.
Yeah.
But, you know, if you're truly curious and truly, you know, find joy in it, like, just keep asking.
Yeah.
Just keep saying, oh, can I watch? Can I shadow? Even if it means, you know, staying after your night shift. I worked overnights when I first started. Not a lot of surgery happening overnights, not a lot of PET scans happening overnights. So I would stay a few hours in the morning, you know, with permission, of course, to be able to see these different procedures being performed.
Mm-hmm.
And then eventually it was, oh, well, Shannon's available. She can go do,
yeah.
She can go do the ISAT.
Yeah. Which is extremely, as a former owner of a neurodiagnostics company, that's what we look for mm-hmm. in technologists. You make yourself extremely valuable. And that's what I believe I did as a tech as well, mm-hmm. is I would get really interested and kind of broaden my scope. So for EEG techs out there who might be working PRN, who actually want a full time or more hours, or you know, concerned about, for whatever reason, I know there's a lot of concern about the EEG field itself. If you have those concerns, branch out, make yourself so utilitarian that mm-hmm. you can actually go in, do so many different things. And also it's fun.
It's
right?
so fun.
It's so fun to just branch out into something different. It adds a little bit of spice to your week.
Mm-hmm.
It adds a little bit of variety to what you do.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, honestly, if I were to do it again as an EEG tech, I would double down on this one thing,
mm-hmm.
and that is broaden my scope of knowledge. You see Shannon do it. I spoke with Jay Jones earlier. Mm-hmm. He's also done that. And you see, when people thrive in our industry, that is a common thread, is that they go through many different modalities and they learn them, and then they become indispensable because they're utility players.
Yeah.
And that is so huge in an ever-changing healthcare system where some departments they fluctuate, right? The EEG department can fluctuate.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, unfortunately, hospitals are laying people off, but then they're understaffed. And if you can navigate that through your experience by providing, you know, the hospital your experience. Mm-hmm. It's a win-win situation because you get to do fun stuff that you like to do, breaks up the week, and the hospitals are looking at you, your supervisor's looking at you, like I'm sure they did you, mm-hmm. and said, wow, she can do just about anything. Mm-hmm. So that would probably be my number one advice as a business owner looking at someone to hire. Mm-hmm. And I think it's just such a great idea. And it's awesome that you've done that.